This is Bike Tourist Podcast, show number 14. My name is Gabriel. If you're new to this podcast, well, grab a chair and enjoy the show we have prepared for you. And if you're a regular listener, thanks for coming back. Summer is just around the corner, and with it comes some nice opportunities for bike touring. Several destinations come to mind. Whatever you choose, make sure you do your homework about the place you're going to visit. Countries vary in many things, and weather is one of them. Depending on where you go, you have to choose the right clothing. In the tropics, for example, the humidity keeps the temperature from going to extremes, but the price to pay is sweat. So you have to make sure you have appropriate means of hydration. In other regions, like North and South America, you can find extremes on both sides of the mercury scale. So your clothing has to be flexible to handle the situation, without adding bulk and extra weight. In the United States, there are some touring routes that expose the bicycle tourist to a variety of changing weather. One of these routes is the Trans-American Trail, or more commonly known as the Trans-Am. With more than 4,000 miles, it crosses the US. How do you manage and plan for such a route and deal with what is in there for you? Well, we have Mr. David Barnes from Buffalo, New York, to share with us his experiences in the Trans-Am as well as other routes he has done. Enjoy this interview, brought to you in part by Adventure Cycling, the largest bicycle touring organization in North America. Visit them at www.adventurecycling.org.
Bike Tourist Podcast.
Hello, David. How are you?
Hello, Gabriel. And hello to all the bike tourists out there who are listening.
Okay, and say hello to the audience and tell us a few words about you.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome, bike tourists. And a little bit about myself. I'm 34. When I was 23, I rode across the United States on the adventure cycling Trans-American Trail. And that was a while ago, and ever since then, I've been doing a few much shorter tours here and there. And, well, that's it, I guess, for now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Riding the Trans-Am must be an exciting experience. I've read this is more than 4,000 miles. What did you decide to do it?
How did I get to doing it?
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you choose to do the Trans-Am? I know that sometimes the road have a calling for riders, but this is a very long trail. And what moved you to do the Trans-Am?
It all started when I was in the Boy Scouts. An older fellow in the troop brought his friend that had biked across the country. And from what I can remember, they went from Seattle across Canada and down to Albany. And I thought that was really neat, and I always thought I wanted to do something like that. And when I did decide to do it, I didn't quite know as far as a route that I wanted to do. I thought it would be cool to start in San Francisco only because there was a friend that was supposed to move out there at the time, and that never happened. And I basically got kind of lazy. I spent all my time figuring everything else out but the route, believe it or not. But somebody had told me at a bike shop here about the adventure cycling, so I looked into it, and it just seemed like the perfect trail, and it had all the places where you can camp and a lot of the places that I had wanted to see out west. So for a little bit of money, I got a whole set of maps, and it just took the whole burden off my shoulders.
Mm. Now that you mention a little money, I think this is the part that most bicycle tourists and people who want to start on bicycle touring want to hear about. How much, if you can tell us, if you remember, How much was it for your first touring setup? You know, regarding bikes, what equipment did you get for doing the adventure?
Sure. Well, I actually spent. I wanted. Or I set myself for $1,000 budget for however long it was going to take me. So that's what I actually spent on the road. That's what I had in the ATM machine from the beginning. Everything else, I don't really know off the top of my head. I did get a mount. I rode a mountain bike, a GT Tequesta. Back then, there was no suspension on your standard bike from the shop. I had a Jand front and rear panniers, Blackburn racks, a lowrider rack in the front. And yeah, it was all a chunk of change. It did cost some money. Panniers are not cheap. I think those were like $150. The fronts are $100. And oh, the bike I think was like $400 or $500, but I don't remember. I had kind of planned to live on the cheap side. I wanted to camp every night. By no means did I want to stay at a motel unless I absolutely needed to. So I tried to keep it cheap.
Yeah, okay.
And I like to go camping.
Yeah, yeah. This is what most people want to do. Me included. I visualize myself when doing a bike tour. Just camping. Hotels are nice, and especially if there is a big downpour. But camping is in the blood. Camping is in the blood, and I think it's a more direct way to connect with nature and with what you're doing. Tell us, from where did you took the whole Trans Am Trail? Tell the audience what is comprised on the Trans Am, from where to where and passing through where, so they have an idea if they don't know what the Trans American Trail is.
Sure, the Trans American Trail is the one in particular. They have three of them. They have a north and a south. The last time I checked. And one in the middle, which is the Trans-America Trail. And that starts on the coast of Oregon, and that goes all the way to Richmond, Virginia. I don't know the city in Oregon it starts. I started only for convenience because that's where the train took me, 100 miles off the coast in Eugene, Oregon. I took the train out west and did the opposite from what I was told of a lot of people do. And I biked to the east. I took the train out to Portland, went down to Eugene, and just started from there. And that goes through, and the trail goes through Oregon, Idaho, and it takes you up into northern Idaho, up into Montana, to Missoula, which is where the Adventure Cycling headquarters is. That's where they're out of. And it takes you down into Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, and then the Virginias. I deviated considerably. I through mid-Kentucky, I think I skipped Kentucky there when I mentioned the state. Through mid-Kentucky, I cut up north through Ohio to go home because my plan was to, instead of going coast to coast, a lot of people dip their bike tires in the oceans, which is neat. I would have liked to have done that, I must admit. However, I wanted to bike home. I thought that would have been more significant for me personally. I actually wanted to bike up and kiss the driveway of my home, and that's what I did. And I actually skipped going to Missoula, Montana. I completely skipped that. Idaho was a state that I really wanted to see, and I had met up with some other bikers in Oregon there, right on the border of Oregon and Idaho, and they helped me kind of plan out I went out and bought a map, and we planned a route, and that actually happened to be my favorite state, my favorite route, and the best time I think I had in that off-the-cuff planned route through Idaho. Not to put the Trans-America Trail down by any means, just my deviation just happened to be fantastic.
Yeah, I just think that the trails are there. For me, the way I see things is like they are like a guideline. Say, if you want to go from east to west or west to east, you can do this. But it's up to the rider who's going to do the final plans. Listen, talking about things you took with you for doing such a long travel, what things that you bring, how much weight were you carrying on your bike to start with?
I never officially weighed it. However, I did have some other bikers. I did meet a lot of bikers, by the way, along the way. I did travel maybe 2/3 of the time with other people, even though I was by myself. And I had other bikers just through chit-chatting. I would get off my bike and they'd lift it dead weight. And I was told it was everything was 90 pounds. And that was later. That was much, much later. Over in Colorado area, I think I met a guy that lifted it up and said it was 90, and somebody else lifted it up and said it was about the same. But I did, however, dump a lot of stuff in Oregon. I got sick really bad, and I stayed at a camp, an RV campground, for a couple of days. And there were some bikers there that I'm friends with to this day. They biked around the world for 3 years, and they really gave me a lot of pointers. And we laid out all my equipment, all my clothes, and all my belongings out on the lawn of the campground. And he basically did you can get rid of this, you can use this, you can get rid of that. And I ended up mailing a medium-sized box home the next morning, so it considerably cut down my weight. And I was pretty loaded down in the beginning, I must admit, through inexperience, but I think that's what we all go through when we first do such a trip.
Yeah. From what those things that you stripped from your trip, what things were included? I got rid of this, got rid of that. What were those things? Because right now we have many listeners just trying to figure out what to bring, what not to bring. Give us an example of what are the things that you really needed and things that were completely out of the question and were of no need at all, and you got rid of them.
Yeah. Well, I think I overdid it on the clothes. That's first and foremost. I had four bicycle jerseys. I had two cheap ones and two nice expensive ones, racing jerseys. They weren't racing jerseys. I take that back. They were just nice wicking jerseys. I got rid of two of those. I had a regular towel. That went back, a heavy cotton towel. Not a big one, but too bulky, too heavy. Didn't need it. I had a backpacking towel anyway. I must back up. A lot of my stuff, I had a lot of the stuff I already had previously from camping and backpacking. I had, that's where I kind of had the advantage where I was already an experienced hiker and backpacker, so I had the backpacking stove, and I had the pants that zip off into shorts, which there wasn't a lot of back in 1996. I got a lot of heavy clothing, regular clothing, and I basically just kept it to two pairs of shorts, two shirts. I didn't get rid of too many socks. Just clothing, really. Didn't need too much. I brought it, and I figured that I would eventually either get rid of it somehow or mail it home if I didn't need it.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. One thing, there are a variety of terrain on the Trans-Am, from very dry to very humid. Have you had any problems adapting to the different conditions? For example, if you are riding in some kind of conditions and then you accustomed to this and then you ride into another region and it's completely different, how did you manage to adapt for these conditions? Tell us about what you found.
Well, I guess the disadvantage of riding from west to east, which I assume is why people don't do this, is because when you start from the east, you're starting out kind of flat. Although I heard, I didn't go through the Virginias, but I heard the, I think that's the Blue Ridge Mountains there, the steepest and the worst of the Trans Am Trail, but I can't say out of experience. But starting from the east, besides the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Virginias, it's flat until you get to the Rocky Mountains. And then it's so gradual, you can get into the mountainous terrain, and by then, you've ridden so many miles half across the country, you should be in shape enough to handle the mountains. In my case, I just started right into the mountains, and I have to admit, I wanted to quit about the fourth or fifth day in. I was at a real all-time low. It was extremely difficult physically, but that's quickly overcome. With a week or two, your body gets used to the rigors of cycling. But Oregon is extremely mountainous, very, very mountainous. Idaho is a good mix of flat and very mountainous. Colorado was so gradual. Wyoming gets you up into Colorado, and you're going up and up and up, and you don't really realize it. And when you're in Colorado and you realize you're in the Rockies, and you realize what elevation you're at some point, it didn't feel like you climbed very much because it's so gradual. And yeah. Then Kansas was is the typical what everybody says and what you see on TV. It is flat and hot. And the weather in Kansas was insane. It was either hot like an oven, like you open a oven door and the heat from, say you're baking a cake and the heat comes up as you open the oven, the winds were like that as it was for me. And when it wasn't hot, it was the weather was extreme in the sense of thunder, lightning, the storms were intense. Yeah. I had three, it took me 7 days, 7 to 8 days across, and I had three of the worst storms I'd ever seen in my life. Mm. And Kentucky was very, Illinois was easy, Kentucky was easy. It's all just rolling and flat.
Yeah, what?
And I was just going to say, the West is probably, for nature lovers and outdoors enthusiasts, is our playground. When you get out towards the east, it's beautiful. Kentucky was beautiful. But once I got into Ohio and started to go home from that point on, it was a little, scenery-wise, it was a little on the boring side.
Mm. One thing, I have heard that there is a problem in, I don't know if back then it was a problem, but many, many cyclists have told me that in Kentucky there was a problem with stray dogs attacking cyclists. Did you? Is the national capital of stray dogs for cyclists? Tell us, do you have a story about that?
Well, I encountered dogs, no stray dogs, but dogs, yes. Had quite a few. And it's like a common thing. They chase you down and they nip at your ankles or your panniers. I had a little can of mace. Didn't carry a gun. People thought I was crazy for not carrying a gun, by the way. But, yes, I carried a little can of mace that my friend's mom gave me. And never had to use it on a dog. I guess the most common thing was to use a water bottle to squirt it in their face. But along the Trans Am Trail, there's cafes and diners where we all stop at, and each of these places has a logbook you can sign and write some comments in there for other people in the future that are going to sign it and look into it. And I kept seeing, watch out for the three-legged dog in Kentucky. And you kept seeing it in logbooks over and over in all the different states, watch out for the nasty three-legged dog in Kentucky. And it just started to get built up, and then you start asking other bikers that you run into, and everyone's talking about this dog, and I never did run into him. However, I heard he had died. I ran into to a biker that was from Kentucky going west, and he says, "Oh yeah, yeah, I know about the three-legged dog. He died a year ago, so I never got to see the three-legged dog." But I was just waiting for it, like some sort of battle or something. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, you know, I read once in a journal in Crazy Guy on a Bike that this bike tourist was going down the, I think it was that same road. And you know, there are some dogs that they are not, like you say, they are not just stray. They are from houses, and they just they just sit around on the side of the road just waiting for bikers. So this this big dog tries to attack this the rider. I don't remember his name. It's a shame. I remember his name. So he just stopped and put the bicycle in between him and the dog, and the dog barking. And then the owner of the dog come out. Don't bother my dog. I say, don't bother my dog. He's trying to
bite. The other way around.
Yeah, he's trying to bite me. And the dog. So I say, listen, take your dog away, or going to mace him. Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
And the dog continue barking. So the guy took out his the can of mace. When the dog saw the can, he just and then he just went back to the home. So it seems that the dog has been already maced.
Luckily I never had to use mine.
Yeah.
But actually I made a game out of it, and some other bikers I was with at various times did too, where when one would come ripping out of somebody's yard or from somewhere, we'd kind of make it a challenge to see if we can outrace it so it wouldn't catch us. And so we kind of made a game out of it instead of just going leisurely and wanting to shoot it with mace. But the water trick seemed to work pretty well most of the time.
Yeah.
It would just stop them in their tracks and enough to not want to go after you anymore.
Yeah, I have a thing with dogs. If you have heard my previous podcast, I fell due to two dogs that attacked me. So dogs is an obligated topic in the...
They don't like bikers, I know that.
Yeah. Now I have my can of mace and right away singing a low song. Okay, now that you mentioned that you took the route on the, like many people would say, from the wrong side, and you have to deal with that. You know, it's good to hear that it was actually hard, not hard for you, but that sometimes a rider starts doing a bike tour and then a couple of days later say, "Oh, I want to go home." And this thing is overcome every day. And you already mentioned how you dealt with that. I would like to know, from all the places you went, I've heard there are some places that there are many people that help riders away, and they are on the look for riders which might need something. Have you ever came across these kind of people to give you what they say road magic?
Yes, they're all over the Trans Am Trail. Well, they were when I did it in '96. I don't know if any of them are around anymore. I'm sure there's some that are still there. I'm sure there's some new ones. But, yes, everyone had nicknames of families or people that would take bikers in that live right on the road of the trail. There was a family in Missouri. There's two. There was some other ones or some in Virginia, but I didn't go through there, so I don't know. And there was a lady out in Wyoming that took me in, a family in Idaho that took me in, two families in Idaho that took me in. And like I've heard in your previous podcasts with other people, other bike tourists, I can agree with them 100% that people are amazing when you're out on the road, how friendly people are that come up and talk to you, and then you happen to be camping in that town that night, and they want to take you in. They want to feed you. They want to give you a shower and a place to camp instead of going to find something. And yeah, it's great. And like I said, I wanted to camp every night, but I'm not going to turn down somebody's backyard or somebody's home when they offer it to me, that's for sure.
Me neither.
I took quite a few breaks. I took two scattered, obviously. I took scattered 2 weeks off the road. And I stayed with my cousin in Cincinnati, my aunt and uncle in Missouri, and they just happened to be right on my way home. And yeah, it was great to just stop and take time off and relax. I wasn't on the road constantly. And I actually had to learn that. My initial idea was to just go straight from Eugene to Buffalo and don't stop and cover 100 plus miles a day. And when I got sick at the end of Oregon there, I completely stopped and turned my attitude around and took my time and enjoyed myself a lot more.
Yeah, it's a thing that here in where I live, here in the island of Puerto Rico, you know, it's really hard because the island is quite small. The island is quite small, and so everybody has the attitude of going from point A to point B as fast as possible, and I'm brag about it. I imagine that in your case, you just went there trying to cover as much distance, and then you say, "What I'm doing?" You know, because if you're going to arrive maybe in 2 or 3 days, then you say, "Oh, okay, I arrive." Boom. But if you're going to stay that long, how much time were you on the road? I think the Trans Am take like a couple of months. How long were you on the road?
I was on the road for 91 days.
91? And
that's included my days off, so.
Yeah, so is what I say. Maybe you start fast, and then you see that the road is it never comes to an end, and you continue and say, "Oh, what am I doing?" Tell me.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm a bit jealous of some other bike tourists that I've listened to from your podcast that have done the 8, 10, 12, 15,000 miles, 20,000 miles. And I only did 4,265, and I thought that was an accomplishment. And I probably could have kept on going, but once I got home, I thought about going to the East Coast to Boston, but I didn't. I stopped.
Yeah, there's a time for everything, I think.
yeah.
Okay. Tell me.
Oh, but you're right about people going fast across the country. It has its place. That just wasn't my thing. I kind of thought about doing that, like I said, but I quickly dropped that idea and decided to take my time.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think the concept of bike touring that we are trying to convey here in this podcast is the one where you and your bike, maybe a solo or with a friend or a group of friends, enjoy the road as much as possible and take it easy to have time to smell the flowers. You know,
exactly.
There are some other events, for example, the Elite Tour that is going to be held on June 10, and where Fred Matheny, which we interview him here in the podcast, they are going to do like 1,700 miles in 17 days. But this is another kind of event. It's another kind of event. I covered it here because most of the conditions that bike tourists have to handle, they are going to handle, because it will be 17 days. It's a lot of distance. You know, it's a lot of miles to cover, and you have to be prepared for that. But in the case of...
Yeah, that's great if they can do that, but I just want to convey out there to anybody that is going to get into bicycle touring or wants to do it, it's completely up to you as far as, you know, you're out there on your own. It's completely up to you whether you want to go fast or slow, or, hey, I want to go down this road and check this out, or I want to take a look at this, or hey, I want to stop for the day. You can do anything you want. And that's what's great about it. It's certainly not a race. It's just an adventure at your own pace.
Okay. You have you mentioned that you had a MySpace page where you're slowly uploading information about your tour. Can you tell the people where to reach? What's your name on MySpace, or they can see your adventure?
Yeah, it's my URL is JerkaBobber. Jerkabobber. It's an old goofy name from somebody that was in the Boy Scouts when I was younger, and it's just something that I stuck with because it was the only thing I could think of at the time.
Yes, yeah, we are going to put a link on the page so people can go there and click and go there directly. You have photos over there and information.
Yeah,
about,
quite a few photos. Yeah.
Yeah. So
of other tours I took on there as well. So.
Yeah, tell us briefly about the other tours you have done, the places, just briefly, so people know and then go to your page and know all about it.
Yeah, they were all local as far as the state, except for I went back to Yellowstone National Park, which by the way the Trans Am does go through, and was probably my favorite place in the United States. It's absolutely incredible there. It's so alien and strange. I could have spent a week there, but I went back in 2003, I think it was, and I flew my bike out there and myself, and I biked half of what I didn't see on my cross-country trip. And that was quite an adventure. I got snowed on. I encountered buffalo and elk. And Yellowstone, believe it or not, is not that hard of a terrain to bike. It's rolling and hilly, but it's not extremely mountainous. You're up in the mountains, but it's not that bad. And that was a fun trip. And the other tours that I've done, the Yellowstone was 4 or 5 days. And Yellowstone was fun. I recommend it to anyone, any nature enthusiast. The other trips that I've done 2 in the Finger Lakes area. That's in central New York. They're long, deep lakes, and it's a great place for growing wine. One of the trips I did in there, I did before my Trans America Trail trip. Just to see if I could handle that many miles. We did about 500 miles on that up for me and a friend of mine. And I actually did another trip there. There's wineries. There's wineries all over the place there. They're like every other mile. And we stopped at wineries and was wine tasting the whole time. And that was just a short. That was like 2 days.
Uh-huh. So were you able to keep your bike straight while?
Yeah. I mean, near the end of the one day, we must have hit like 6 or 7 of them. And we got a little buzz near the end of the day and had a long climb going back up into the camp. We were fine.
Yeah, so
we were getting to the point where we were just going in just to taste the wine and not buy anything.
Yeah, so you were not just burning calories and carbohydrates, you were burning alcohol too. So
that's right. And I actually bought, I don't remember, I think it was like 6 or 7 bottles I had in my pannier. So it was pretty heavy too. So it was funny.
Okay.
It was good company on that trip too. There was 4 of us, so... I haven't been on a tour with that many people. I'm usually by myself or with my other friends, so that was fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, going back to the Trans Am, you know, the Trans Am is transit by many people. Did you find many people during your tour? Did you, make friends or something? Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. What's great... Well, you find bikers, it seems, anywhere when you're out doing a tour, but the Trans Am in particular attracts a lot of tourists. It's the I guess the Tour de France of biking across the country, and you're almost guaranteed to run into a couple of them going both ways. I made a lot of friends. The couple I met biking around the world, I would bike with them for a couple of days, and then I would get ahead of them, and then I would stop, and they would catch up with me, and you cross paths with other bikers, and that was an aspect of the trip that I totally didn't expect. I thought I'd be out there all by myself and not see another biker, but it was totally the opposite. Ran into them all the time, and it got fun running into other people and exchanging stories. So I think that's a really nice part of the Trans Am Trail is, I mean, if you really want to be by yourself, you probably might want to do something else, but you always end up running into somebody.
Yeah, you know, this is one point you raise here, and you know, when I started biking, you know, I started biking very young, but then I just put it off for many reasons. I have explained that in other shows of the podcast. But when I got back to cycling, I started going with groups of road riders. And this is the thing with what happened, what you were expecting, that you were going to be left behind, but this time I was not prepared for that. You know, I thought, oh, we are going to have this wonderful Saturday ride, you know, everyone is here, so let's go. And they just started going faster and faster and faster. You know, so wait, you know, yeah, and one of them came back to me and said, oh, listen, we want to go faster. Is that okay with you? I said, okay, if you want to go, go. I'll go with myself. So I did
Yeah,
that.
that.
Tell me.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's an interesting point too. Quite a few of the bikers that I traveled with, they would just say, "Well, look, I'm faster than you, and I'm camping at this point at the end of the day, I think." So, and I say, "Well, I am too," and I say, "Well, maybe I'll meet you there." And that's how it works sometimes. And sometimes it got so lonely for me in particular that I actually wanted to be with somebody, so I would go at their pace. So it all depends on the person, and but no, I know exactly what you mean. Some people are much faster, so they politely go up ahead of you and say, "I'm much faster than you. I'll see you later."
Yeah, you know, so some people just cannot go slow. You know, I think the second or third time that happened to me, I just decided to go solo. So I had a better time. I just took my pace and took time to smell the roses and you know, but I have read other journals in Crazy Guy on a Bike, particularly that they start as a group, but each one goes at its own speed. And then they know they are going to maybe go to a hostel or something. They know the destination. So at different times of day, they just meet again. And then next day they go, some go first, the other. I don't know. I think I could travel like that. But if I travel with someone, I like to keep company. Or I decide or go with company or go alone. But this
Yeah,
alone company.
it's tough. I like being by myself, but I do have a good friend of mine that does this, so I like to be with him. It depends, but yeah, I forgot what I was going to say,
Yeah. We were talking about the being the different kind of
Oh,
people. Yeah.
yeah, I got my train of thought back. Before I did my Trans Am Trail, I've always wanted to do it. And when it came back into the thought of being a reality, I was discussing with a friend to do it. That's how it came up. We were talking about things we always wanted to do. So my one friend was supposed to do it with me, but he didn't. So I look back on it and think, well, I wonder how different it would have been if I was with him, because you get treated, that's another thing, is you get treated very differently by strangers, not just other bikers, but strangers that take you in and want to feed you and let you camp in their backyard and whatnot. You get treated different when you're by yourself, so you get a little more spoiled. So things would have been a little different, I think, if I had been with somebody else. That's for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have some other adventures that you want to share with us on other bike trips? You know, so far we have been talking about the good things of bike touring, and this is good. But sometimes some riders confront some kind of problems, or you know, sometimes it's the bike, sometimes it's the route. There are different kind of problems. Have you run into any trouble when you are doing a bike tour?
Yeah, I think I had one of each on my Trans Am trip. Boy, where do I start? Well, I got really sick at the end of Oregon, and I had to in Oregon, the beginning of Idaho. I had to hang around for a few days. I actually went to the emergency room. I was depleted chemically. I didn't keep up my electrolytes and everything, and I had eaten bad food, and it was cold. So I just got violently sick. I didn't have too many bike problems, but I think the most interesting was the weather. That brought up the most interesting adventures in Kansas. It took me, I think, 8 days to cross Kansas, and that 3 of the 8 days was a mass of lightning storms and rain. It come down so fast and hard. The streets in some of these towns, the sides of the road that collects the rain,
wow,
are deep gullies. And it was dry when I had saw them, and I said, wow, that's awfully deep. And I had no clue what that was for, and I said, until it rained. And the one time I was right out in the middle of Kansas in Larned, actually, I stopped and camped there. I was in the middle of the day. It was a hot day. They have public pools in all these Kansas towns that you can stop at. So I had gone swimming that day. I had camped. I'd stopped. I'd camped. I'd gone swimming. And there was a guy, a lifeguard there, that was about my age. And I have some tattoos, and we were talking tattoos. So he kind of got to know me for a minute, and he knew what I was doing. He knew I was biking cross country. And that was the last I saw of him until a couple hours later. The park was empty. Everyone was gone. And night was coming on. And a car comes up into the park, up to my tent. And the guy, the lifeguard kid that I'd talked to in the pool, he had come out and said, hey, look, there's a huge tornado coming.
Yeah, really? Tornado?
You need to...
Now you freak me out.
You need to come with me. And I'm like, what, huh? He's like, yeah, you really need to put your equipment in my car and come with me. This sounds bad to the non-bike tourist. It sounds like a con artist trying to kidnap me or something, but no, we went to his house.
It's not about the bike.
What's that?
It's not about the bike. It's just a tornado.
Yeah. It's not about stealing anything from you or anything. No, there's a tornado coming, and he was right. You know, I don't listen to the weather when I'm out on the road like that, so I didn't have a radio. I didn't pay attention to that stuff. So we were in his house, in his basement. The sirens were going off in Larned, and everyone at that point has to go into the basement of their homes, and you're not allowed to go up until the sirens are off. And we were down there playing darts, and the power's going on and off, and we're playing darts when the lights are on, lights go off, we stop. It was unlike anything I've ever seen before from Buffalo, New York.
Wow.
And the winds were unbelievable, over 100-mile-an-hour winds outside.
Wow. So you could easily have played, you know, that scene of the little guy on the bike riding through the moon.
Yeah.
Continue.
I I don't even want to think what happened. He told me that he's like, right now, and it was later, it was like hours later, he's like, right now, that park where your tent was flooded a couple of feet. So you would have been completely flooded. And if not that, and or my tent would have been destroyed from the winds. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And what the funny thing about it all was, it was nothing to him or the other residents, I take it. So we, after the sirens were over, we went upstairs, got in his car, went outside, we went to the store to rent a movie, to watch a movie the rest of the night. And on the drive to the movie, we're dodging down tree limbs, random fires, people are out, power lines are down.
Wow.
There's tiles from people's houses ripped off. I was like, oh my God, I could have been in this.
Wow.
And I was in two other storms that weren't that bad, but yeah, to the Trans Am people out there that are going to do it, just keep an eye out for Kansas. I mean, that was just my experience.
Wow. You know, just imagine, you know, you come from Buffalo, and you're not used to tornadoes, right?
No.
Yeah. So
no, just
yeah. So
occasional high wind.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So just imagine that you were going on in a car trip, and you had to meet these people, and you get caught in the middle of this just because you didn't meet the right person at the right time. And I think this tells a lot about bike touring, because you get to know people. And who will tell you that this person that you're meeting now is going to save your life? Because this is maybe actually what happened, right?
Exactly. I still think back to that when I think about my trip. And I thought, I would have been out of a tent. There's no way my tent would have survived that. And it did. Actually, there was a nasty windstorm that came up over the mountains in Idaho. And somebody there said the winds got up to 60 miles an hour. So my tent was staked to the ground, but the center post was bending past 45 degrees. So I know it was surviving 60 mile an hour winds, but that was nothing compared to the storm in Kansas. And as far as I know, there wasn't any kind of outdoor stores out there that I knew of. So I don't know what I would have done. My tent would have been destroyed and I would have been in trouble. So I don't know. That's the thing about today, as opposed to when I did it 11 years ago, is the gadgetry now is so much more sophisticated. You know, we didn't have iPods and GPS units back then. So
yeah,
I just had my bike computer.
Yeah.
I actually had a tape player.
Yeah, maybe just a Walkman or.
I had a. Some of you out there.
Yeah,
are gonna laugh.
Yeah,
but I had a tape player.
Yeah,
I had a Walkman with seven tapes.
You know, I have a portable quotes in there. A CD player. I still have it. It's great. But you know, this CD player used like 8 AA batteries. And the batteries lasted only 3 hours. And now I see units as the portable CD player that use maybe one battery or two batteries, and it lasts 30 hours. Oh my God, times are unbelievable.
And it's amazing the MP3 players and iPods now can fit, you know, your whole entire CD collection in there, and you can listen to the radio on them and everything. So,
yeah.
Back then, I didn't have any kind of way to
like some people
forecast the weather.
Yeah, exactly. Like some people tell me, I have a small radio. I have a small radio that has a weather alert. But in here, you know, in the island, we don't have tornadoes. Maybe some kind of marine maelstrom or something, but it barely. I've seen only two. One was last year, and the other like 20 or 30 years ago. We do have hurricanes, but you know, you don't need a weather radio to know that there are hurricanes coming, because it is all on the news and the TV and everywhere. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a different kind of experience. These sudden storms, you know, I'm not used to that. Man, I don't know what I would do if I would be in that kind of situation. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty extreme. I've been reading some crazy guy on a bike stories, and I haven't run across anything like that yet. And yeah, the other two storms were almost as bad. But yeah, one, there was a huge pavilion, and it was so big that I didn't even put up my tent. I just laid down on the ground and just left everything the way it was.
Where was that?
That was in Kansas as well.
Kansas too?
And this was, yes, it was a huge pavilion, another park in a town in Kansas. Gigantic pavilion, and I just went to the middle of it and just laid out my my Therm-a-Rest and my sleeping bag. And I said, well, I'm not going to put up my tent. I got this huge pavilion. Well, a massive storm came through there, and it was blowing so hard that it was blowing the rain vertically right into the gazebo, and me and all of my stuff got soaked. I mean, except my handlebar bag that had my my electronic stuff in there and my journal. But that hail came down, and it was just, yeah.
You know, hail. At least you had your helmet, just in case.
I was under the gazebo, but it was blowing stuff in sideways.
Oh.
It was so bad, it would be blowing you. I got up and walked around to try to get to a house for shelter, because there was some houses around the park, and it was blowing me sideways. I was knee-deep in water from the rain in the street. That's how fast it was coming down, and that's how much it fills up the ground. It doesn't get saturated right away. So it was, like I said, from Buffalo, I've never seen anything like that before.
Wow. You know, you're telling so many things in here about the what happened to you on the trip. Are you keeping a journal on that? I know that you had a MySpace page, but are you going to compile everything, or are you doing something for putting this on writing so people can go and browse and stuff?
Yeah, like you said, I'm on MySpace. That was my first outlet to, I guess, publish my journals, I guess you can say. My original idea years ago was to make a book, but I don't know, I just didn't do it. Other things in life got ahead of me, and I just never got around to it. So just recently, I am putting my journals each day, one by one, on MySpace and on crazyguyonabike.com.
Okay. Yeah, we will make sure that all those links will go into the podcast page. So,
I
do this with everyone, you know? But you know, it's good that adventures they just don't be kept in memory. It's good to share, and that's why I created this show for people who can share adventures. They do it in this open forum, and it will be great.
Yeah,
tell me.
That's great, because I certainly love reading other people's bike tour stories, and I just thought I might add that my writings are a lot more detailed than some other ones I've read. They're very vague, under a paragraph or a couple sentences for a day. I get into just about everything that went on that day. So if you don't mind reading and you want to get into the details of my trip, you can read it. I get quite into it.
Yeah, we make sure that we put those links on the page. I'll tell the audience that visit the page because we put other details that are not included in the interview. We put in there. Sometimes we get links to related sites, some other stuff. So it's always good to check on the page, not just download the show. The show is made to stand by itself, but it's always good to complement what you hear in the show with what you find in the web page of the Bike Tourist Podcast.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay. Well, it's been great to have you here and sharing with us the all your adventures. I know that maybe you have a lot more things to say for the listeners. We could make some chapters of the show. But for now, I think it's good as an introduction to the work, written work you are doing on your MySpace and on the Crazy Guy on a Bike. So it's like a teaser. So people go there and experience what you experience. Do you have any closing words for the bike tourists? Any advice for a people that are just starting out? Because there are a lot of people that are experienced riders, but there are many people that are just waiting to do the jump. Do I do it or don't? I just in this moment of their lives that they want to do something, let's use the word outrageous, and maybe going on a bike tour is a definition of outrageous. At least it's for me. What do you have to say to all these people that are just wanting to do a tour, but they don't get to the decision of doing it?
What all the other bike tourists have been saying, just do it. You won't regret it. And if you regret it while you're doing it, you won't later, because you will be looking back on it and saying what a wonderful time you had, because it wasn't a good time while you were doing it, but you'll have a good laugh afterwards. And you want to do another one. If you're into biking and you're into travel and getting out there and doing things the slow way, you'll definitely enjoy it. So that's it really. Just do it and get to know your bike and your equipment and a well-planned route. And that's it. And if I've at least encouraged one person out there listening to do a tour, then I'm happy with myself, because I've gotten them into it. That would make me very happy.
Okay. So David, thank you very much for being on the Bike Tourist Podcast. This is now your home. You're another brother in wheels. They say brother in arms. I don't like to use the word arms. I support our troops, but I just prefer that we cycle. So we are now brothers in wheels, and so the Bike Tourist Podcast is now your home, like other the people that have come here, and you are always welcome here. So let's say goodbye for now, and to all the bike tourists are on there, on the bike tourists to be, just decide, just get your bike and maybe one overnight and go back to your home, get the feel of it. Then maybe
start small.
Very small. Start small and then continue to grow. And the experience you get by maybe doing an overnight in one place, you decide, okay, I'll bike to this place, I'll stay there overnight, maybe cook my food, and then next day come back. The experience you gain just by one night, it translates. Mm-hmm. It translates for a longer tour in the future. Do you have something?
What you can do out there, everybody, is what I like to do: find where you on a map where you live, find the closest, or 40, 50 miles away, a state park or a national park, or some kind of geological object that you wanted to see. I've always wanted to go there, you say to yourself. Well, take a bike tour there and then come home. And that'll just get you started.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's saying goodbye. We are saying goodbye for now. Thank you very much to all our listeners for being on the Bike Tourist Podcast. Until next time.